Welcome back to Plot Pit. In the pit today, John LeMay and I are discussing... John?
Today we're finally going to go to aliens, and I'm shocked it took us this long.
All right, aliens it is in the pit. Let's begin the descent.
Okay, even though we said aliens, and you might be thinking 1940s, 1950s, we're actually going all the way back to the 1870s. Precisely, we're going to start with Taylorsville, Ohio in 1873, and this is going to be one of three real newspaper articles that we're going to conjoin into a hopefully coherent narrative. So, a father and son in Taylorsville, they're in their horse and buggy when they observe basically a UFO land out in the wilderness, and out of the UFO steps a man. And the article says, this man walked a few paces and stepped into a buggy, which had not been observed before by either the man or his son. There was no horse attached to this supernatural vehicle, but no sooner had the man taken his seat than it started to run, noiselessly, but with great velocity, along the highway, and this it continued to do until it reached a deep gully into which it plunged, and when buggy, man, and lantern suddenly disappeared as mysteriously as they came. So Noe Torres and I looked into this case, and it kind of, to us, sounds like an Old West version of the Men in Black. And thankfully, I'm sure everyone listening has seen the Men in Black movies where they have those black sedans that can suddenly take flight and, you know, lift off. So I think it's hilarious that this is a real article from the Old West seeming to describe a man in black. I didn't get into that part of the article, but the man was dressed all in black. And instead of being in a sedan, like in, you know, the movies, he steps into a horse and buggy that's like super powered. I just think that's hilarious. But again, that's only our first story. We've got another one.
And where was this located?
Taylorsville, Ohio.
In Ohio.
And that was precisely on March 22nd, 1873. The next story is also in 1873 on June 26th out of Fort Scott, Kansas. In this case, a bunch of people saw what looked to be a flying serpent or snake up in the sky, and it kind of encircled the sun. And I'll try and find one of the better quotes about it. Let's see. Direct from the article, it seemed to be as large and as long as a telegraph pole, was of a yellow striped color, and seemed to float along without effort. And again, you know, just back then, because it was snake-like, they described it as a giant snake as opposed to a UFO, and it basically kind of encircled the sun. In fact, they called it a sea serpent of the sun. And so it was just kind of a strange phenomenon. And I have in my mind how I'm going to link all these together, and I think Will is going to do it in a totally different direction, so that's going to be interesting. So our third and final article that we're going to use in our little story comes from about a year later.
Now we're 1874.
Yeah, 1874, and a place that some UFO fans will recognize, Pascagoula, Mississippi, because in 1973 they had this really strange UFO sighting there with these aliens that had like carrot noses, which I don't think we'll go into because that muddies our story. We're going to stay with this story from 100 years before, so forget all about the carrot nose aliens. I don't think we're going to use them, at least I'm not. August 13th, 1874, Pascagoula, Mississippi. The town experiences not exactly a UFO, but like this strange kind of destructive heat wave. They described it as a cloud of light and also as a luminous electric cloud. And I'm going to dig some quotes from the original article. So one woman, identified as Mrs. Willis, said she put her head out of the front window when she was stifled by the burning hot gust from the west, and it felt as if her hair had been scorched from her head. She instantly thought the house was on fire and ran back to observe the kitchen. She thinks the heat was sufficient to have set the house on fire had it continued a few minutes more. It felt as if she had put her face near a red-hot furnace, and she wasn't the only one. Other people in the area also said that the heat had actually blistered their faces and their hands, and it was just a very intense experience, basically, where this heat cloud just floated over their city and it was almost unbearable. And then it mysteriously disappeared and never came back. And okay, here's a good quote. Several others saw and felt this phenomenon. Some thought the comet had struck us, and others thought Judgment Day had come. So it was kind of an apocalyptic event for a little while. And so this episode's fun. William and I have both kind of crafted, I think, separate stories based on these three. And so...
Well, I think you give me a little too much credit. I read the articles, okay. And I'm going to play this one on the fly. I prepped for the other show.
Next
episode.
So you're going to be like, do you want me to do mine first or do you want to do yours first?
Why don't you start us off?
So my idea is this is basically an Old West Men in Black tale. And I'm not trying to rip off the movie's Men in Black. Something that people should understand is, yes, there's a Men in Black comic book and film series, but the Men in Black allegedly are real. They were first sighted, so to speak. Well, I shouldn't say they were first sighted in the 1950s, but in the 1950s was when they became a thing.
Well, that would be just the general fashion of the time, right? With the black suit, black tie, walking around, going
to work. Exactly, exactly. And, you know, they were associated with UFOs, and, you know, eventually somebody wrote a comic book on it, which got made into a movie. But so my take on this is Old West Men in Black. So I'm going to say that the guy that stepped out of the UFO in that first article, he was a man in black. He was the hero arriving on the scene. And the snake, that the flying snake is whoever the bad aliens are. That's their weird mothership. And you'll remember that the flying snake encircled the sun, which I thought was interesting. And then, if this were actually a movie, we would have to change the dates and condense it, but the 1874 article has an intense heat wave coming upon this town and scorching the people. So I'm thinking, okay, this serpentine UFO, you could even prescribe something kind of satanic to it because it's a serpent. So maybe it's like these satanic aliens that have a flying serpent. And somehow the serpent collects heat from the sun and then shoots it down to Earth, and that's why Pascagoula suffers this horribly intense heat wave, and that would be like the end of the movie where the bad guy's plot is almost coming to fruition and this town is about to be destroyed by this heat wave. Then our Men in Black character, he would do something to save the day, you know, and that's why the heat wave doesn't destroy the town, they just kind of experience it. And that was my neat, easy little way of tying all three articles together.
So as you're describing it, a couple of things that pop into my head are, one, the heat wave sounds like the breath from a dragon. So you could, we could take this, you know, from the perspective of a medieval fantasy type thing set in the Wild West. So Wild West, cowboys, Billy the Kid meets, you know, supernatural fantasy magic Merlin. Okay. And then you've got this evil dragon.
Mm-hmm.
That's one idea. The other thing was specifically targeting some conspiracy theories around climate change and geoengineering or, what is that term that they use in science fiction all the time to
terraforming?
Terraforming, yes. Okay, so we have a terraforming thing. Thank you. Terraforming. We've got this snake that encircles the sun in Kansas, right? Mm-hmm. And it looks like it's a flying object. In my head, that almost sounds like a chemtrail.
Oh, yeah, chemtrails, another conspiracy theory.
Okay, so with that layered into this, we could have two different versions here. You've got this kind of Wild West fantasy, so we're almost bridging the gap there between Billy the Kid type meets Captain Kirk, Star Trek, or Merlin.
Yeah.
You know, so something to that nature in that realm. And if we go with the chemtrail scenario, maybe the aliens that are serpent aliens or whatever are trying to terraform Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that's not an unusual trope to go with. We've seen plenty of film in Hollywood come out with this. So those are kind of the two things that really hit.
Mm-hmm.
I do like your general take on the Men in Black being the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And the question then is, how does he stop this while the serpent dragon slash alien mothership is breathing fire onto this town? Now, remind me where the town is.
Let's see. Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Mississippi. I'm going to tie this a little bit back.
Okay.
And go to our previous episode because Mississippi's not far from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And we had the Ballard disciple being given this electrifying drink, and that cloud was described from Kansas as kind of having an electrifying existence to it. So we could tie those together. I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But we could. So that's where my head's at. And I'm really liking the idea a little bit of running down the Wild West fantasy dragon thing.
Yeah, that was not something I ever considered, and I like that. That's totally interesting.
So we have a fantasy realm set kind of in the 1850s Wild West. This is a before Billy the Kid, before Jesse James. It's before Civil War.
Well, let's see. Actually, it was 1870s. I think you were thinking I said 1850s, but it's 1870s.
You are correct. I'm thinking of something else. 1870s. So you've got Jesse James.
Our next episode is the 1850s. For anyone wondering, that's why it was. So
stay tuned. So 1870s, excuse me, Billy the Kid, Jesse James, post-Civil War, we are in Reconstruction in the southern states when you consider Kansas and Mississippi.
Didn't we do an episode a long time ago about reptilians trying to influence the Civil War or something? Didn't we do that?
We did, yes.
So we could tie it into that too.
So the premise on that was we had an ancient race of reptilians. Reptiles and snakes, so you could tie those together. Mm-hmm. We had an ancient race, long lost. Humans ended up evolving and taking over the planet for whatever reason. Reptiles, in my head, the story would basically be you've got a massive amount of global cooling because of the Ice Age, mm-hmm. so the killed off, basically, or mass extinction event for these reptiles, these intelligent reptiles, which go underground and then start tunneling. Mm-hmm. And the whole of North America is now covered in tunnels. And we had Jesse James, the Howard Association with the mysterious box in Philadelphia, and a clairvoyant coming out of San Francisco. And that's where that reptiles came from, trying to influence the Civil War and then re-emerging at some point, because you had the city in Los Angeles that was discovered, and it was the Lizard People City.
Yeah, and again, folks, almost all of this is real articles. Doesn't mean they're true articles, but we're pulling all this from real articles. Like, the Lizard City comes from something in the 1930s. They excavated this strange city underneath L.A. that they called the Lizard City. And, I think the only thing that we kind of made up of our own was the possibility that these were hyper-evolved, like, dinosaur people. That was our only kind of addition to any of this. But all that other stuff was, you know, allegedly real.
So again, the show is, let's take some interesting, odd stories that are found in the historical record or just objects or sounds or whatever, and then smatter them together and weave them in a manner to create some form of a story.
Now my head is going somewhere. Now, aren't there like some King Arthur Merlin legends where King Arthur is kind of, either King Arthur or Merlin, they're kind of divine, aren't they?
I'm sure that mythos has got a lot. You've got Merlin allegedly aging backwards, which is why he can tell the future.
Okay. Because I was thinking, okay, how about instead of the Man in Black, what if he's the... So let's say we convert this into the Arthurian legend with the dragon. So we could say our Man in Black was really like some angelic being from the stars or something sent to Earth to protect everyone from the dragon that's coming. And so then, you know, you've got the flying dragon that you've got to slay with. Maybe if we're going to convert it to the Old West, the flying dragon has to be slayed not with a sword, but with like a special gun.
Which?
Like Excalibur.
Okay, so you could have it in such the following. This would be really fun. Let's tie it to the Arthurian mythos. Merlin ages backwards. And what he's done is he is the hero of this story, and he has recorded how to kill the dragon, passes it down to King Arthur, and it requires a professor to put the two together and realize that the Arthurian legends are actually metaphorical history of what's being experienced today. Mm-hmm. And so you've got kind of this quest to understand what's going on with this dragon.
Yeah.
And then this professor ties it back metaphorically and connects the dots to what's going on with King Arthur and all of that. And then reads through the lines, deciphers the metaphor, and then applies those legends to today and helps Merlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then says, hey, in the future, or our past, your future, you're going to write this down for us, so don't forget.
Okay, yeah. This one has been really easy to work with. It's almost better when they're hard, because we need more time to fill out.
So we have Merlin as the active hero in this. How does he kill the dragon?
Well, again, I think they always made such a big deal about Excalibur, and I think that since this is the Old West, it has to be an enchanted gun as opposed to an enchanted sword. But I don't know what the gun would be stuck in. Maybe it's stuck in a holster that you can't, nobody can pull this gun out of the holster. I don't know. That sounds stupid. But, you know, Excalibur, you had to pull it from the stone. And
okay, so what we'll do is we'll have a disclaimer at the beginning of the book that tells the reader, bathe this with suspension of disbelief. Yeah. Okay, so Excalibur. We've got the Lady in the Lake, or as the Monty Python show says, the watery tart. And we got the Lady in the Lake who gives Excalibur to King Arthur.
I guess I had it wrong. I always thought he pulled Excalibur out of the stone. Am I wrong?
Well, there's also that story.
Okay.
And so you got the sword and the stone. So we have that myth behind it. Then we've got the Excalibur being given by, maybe it wasn't Excalibur, maybe it was a different weapon.
Hmm.
Or I suppose, well, now I got to go back and look up all of my Arthurian legends. Yeah. It's been so long. I the one that just pops into my head is the Lady in the Lake giving King Arthur a sword, and he has to give it back after he's done with it or something of that nature. And then the Disney movie Sword in the Stone, where you've got the little King Arthur boy who pulls it from the stone because England was in complete turmoil.
So I'm going to say, since we brought up Lady in the Lake, the Old West version of that would be La Llorona, because she comes out of the water. So maybe in this version of the tale, La Llorona is the Lady in the Lake.
Okay. So let's tie that with Quetzalcoatl.
Okay, good. I was thinking the same thing, yeah.
Okay, so we've got Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, for those that don't know, Quetzalcoatl is the Aztec flying plumed serpent god. He's a flying snake.
And the Aztecs were known for
ripping people's hearts out to keep the sun in the sky. Now I see where you're going, because the serpent circles the sun. Good thought.
Okay, so we have the enemy now is not necessarily the dragon, but it's a cult of evil billionaires. I mean, that's a fun one to go with, okay, because they got the financing to orchestrate all of this. And they are trying to resurrect or bring back or call the serpent god Quetzalcoatl back to Earth in some fashion that's taking place in Kansas.
Yeah.
Now, where is this Lady in the Lake that you're talking about?
Well, I guess we just Google ourselves up a lake somewhere in Kansas, I reckon.
Well, I'm talking about the myth that you mentioned a second ago.
Oh, La Llorona?
Yeah, where's that?
She can be anywhere. She's just, you know, the white woman associated with the water, and she's typically bad. You know, but I mean, you can change characters for the sake of a story, so I just can picture her emerging from the water with the enchanted gun to, you know, kill the evil serpent god.
So, she doesn't have to be in Kansas, actually. No. You could have our hero and protagonist of the story go on a quest to get this enchanted firearm from her. So, major area that I would think of that would require some form of quest with all sorts of adventure and challenges to grow the hero in this, so the middle part of the story, would be, why not Salt Lake?
Oh, I like that. Yeah, Salt Lake.
So you've got Kansas separated by the Rockies, and you've got to get to Salt Lake. And through that, it allows you to potentially go into all of the mining areas of Colorado, which has a bunch of tunnels, which you can then tie, if you wanted, to issues with the lizard people or the serpent people or something of that nature. And a lot of the typical tropes that are done with cultists and such is they're looking for secret caves or something of that nature. So in that, maybe there is the mecca of their civilization or their cult or whatever is found in one of those.
Oh, okay. I know. The Aztecs supposedly came from an underground realm called Azatlan. So it could be Azatlan, and Azatlan isn't really a Southwest thing. Some people think Azatlan is up as far as Wisconsin. Some people think it's in Utah or in northern New Mexico. Just basically, the Aztecs always said they came from a land to the north and they emerged from the underground.
Okay, that's kind of interesting, especially with Quetzalcoatl being this flying serpent god. And when we think of snakes and stuff in this area of the world, you don't want to be putting your hands in crevices that you haven't looked into first.
And to circle back to your question, how do we end this? So, I mean, it's pretty hard to get a cowboy up into outer space to shoot this serpent or whatever. So how I look at it is Quetzalcoatl, he was both a man and a serpent. So he could be, like, let's say, in two bodies in two places at once. So he's got his human form on Earth, then the serpent encircling the sun. So I just see, since we're going as a Western retelling of kind of King Arthur type stuff, it's got to end, as opposed to a sword fight, it's just got to end in your typical duel, as silly as that sounds, and our hero just has to shoot Quetzalcoatl with the enchanted gun, and then when his human body dies, the serpent around the sun also dies.
Okay, now, I like this. About the same time you had the shootout at the OK Corral.
Let me think. I think OK Corral might have actually been 1881. I'm not sure.
It's still close to the mid-1870s, yeah. So we can play with some time dates. I mean, artistic license and all. So you can have the posse with our modern day King Arthur, who's this cowboy now that he's coming down from Salt Lake. He's got his posse or whatever. And we could take that final scene showdown that you're talking about and extract elements of that duel from what happened at the OK Corral.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you've got this Quetzalcoatl, who is not a flying serpent in this particular scene. He's got the ability to transform and all that. And what I'm thinking is, let's go back to the theme of the Men in Black, right? You've got this group of folks that are dressed in black. That's what starts the story in Mississippi.
Or not, it was in Ohio. That he came down. Yeah. It was I don't think we have to keep the Men in Black if we don't want to, you know, but yeah.
True. But I'm actually thinking of tying a tailor into this.
I meant to ask you, because I saw your text about an enchanted tailor, and that was cool, so I was going to ask you.
So my thought there is, you've got this hero who has to go into battle with Quetzalcoatl, and so not only does he have to have Excalibur, he needs to have the armor to go with him into battle and protect him. So this is where the tailor would come into play, and you've got this talented tailor who knows how to create this suit that's black to protect the individual from the wiles and darts and lasers or whatever you wanted with the flying serpent god Quetzalcoatl, right? In that final scene. And where this goes is, you've got all of the other myths that follow from the mid-1870s into today about the Men in Black. So this could be the instigating story for all of that mythos line.
Cool.
And that's where the tailor comes into play, is you have this tailor that's kind of like your gadget guru from the James Bond series. What was his name?
Q.
Q, right? So you've got the enchanted tailor guy who knows how to do this stuff. Maybe he's an angel. Maybe he's another benevolent alien race. And you've got this Quetzalcoatl on the other side, which is a competing alien race in some galactic conflict, if you really wanted to expand it out of Earth. Or if you wanted to seriously just isolate it here, you've got Merlin, who could be that enchanted tailor, and he's the one who's not the hero of the story. He has to recruit the King Arthur of the story.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what happened in the King Arthur mythos.
I just love how we started this episode with the intent of aliens, and instead we went to King Arthur. That's what I love. And that's actually what I'm more attracted to if I were to actually write this story out, which I'm not, don't worry. But I'm just, if I were, I think I prefer taking the aliens out and we're just going to retell King Arthur in the Old West. And really the only thing we need is this serpent sighting from Kansas. And I mean, if you can see it from Kansas, I'm sure you could see it from anywhere. So we don't have to be tied down to Kansas, but I like this idea of King Arthur in the Old West, and the only thing we're really keeping, for the most part, is the serpent circling the sun and this enchanted tailor. I think those are all pretty cool.
My particular favorite part of this is the reverse aging of Merlin, where he lives this story in real time, and then realizes that he needs to tell people how to solve this problem. And what he does is he finds, as he's aging through time backwards, the almost same exact setup, and then gets them through it, writes all of this down in story form, right? And, or, I mean, if you really wanted to go down this route, none of that Merlin stuff happened with King Arthur and all of that. Merlin realizes he's about to die, but he needs to transfer that knowledge to the future. So he goes around falsifying and creating all of these myths, explain why a lot of that King Arthur mythos, it's oral legend, but we have no real record of it.
Mm-hmm.
So Merlin wrote all of that down and made it look like, or convinced enough mm-hmm. people to perpetuate those stories forward as a means to where now in today's world, well, 1870s world, right?
Yeah.
That information was not lost. And, you know, I mentioned the professor who has to figure all that out. We totally skipped over his story.
Yeah.
You might not even need that.
Yeah.
But that was just something that came up.
And I kind of like the idea of Merlin actually being in the story as like crazy old man Doc Merlin that nobody believes, but then finally he's right.
Yeah. That's a classic trope that, mm-hmm. you know, the conspiracy theorist that is actually proven true.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, you've been listening to Plot Pit. Your host here, John LeMay, myself. John, you are author of
the book we pulled from today, specifically, I co-authored with Noe Torres, a ufologist in Texas. It is called The Real Cowboys and Aliens, Old West UFOs. All three of those articles that William and I used today can be found in that book. So if you're looking for inspiration in the realm of UFOs and just weird stories you could take and run with, again, Real Cowboys and Aliens, Old West UFOs.
And that is on Amazon.com. I'll leave links in the description of the podcast. Assuming that you can see it, you'll have it there. Otherwise, you can run out to plotbit.com and get the information from that website. In the meantime, if you are interested in being on the show or have ideas for the show or would like to comment and maybe submit some of your own work, email us at submissions@plotbit.com. And we will see you in the next episode, episode 9. We're going to do some interesting stuff with spiritualism.
Do some rapping, but not the kind of rapping you think of.
Yeah, I can't do that. I am not a good human beatbox. All right, folks, you've been listening to Plot Pit. I'm your host, William Atkinson, with host
John LeMay.
And we will catch you in episode 9.